capitalism, it's not a matter of whether you want to take it easy, you don't want to take it easy. It's a system that it's based on competition, and you either grow or you die.
The growth is firstly a hypothesis. Hypothesis that we could live better with less. Or basically that we could achieve equitable redistribution on a global level, along with downscaling or downsizing of the world economy, in a way that we could maintain our levels of well-being or actually improve it.
Edward Abbey wrote that growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of the cancer cell. It is also the economic ideology of the world's most powerful economies. But what if we've grown too much? What if growth is the cancer at the root of such problems as climate change, poverty, and biodiversity loss? This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Many scientists, including myself, argue that this is precisely the case, that growth needs to be done away with, at least as a pursuit in and of itself. And there is a growing consensus around this notion in several fields of science, though there is also vehement disagreement from others who believe that we need smarter growth, greener growth, more growth to grow our way out of the problems that we've created. Today, we're talking about degrowth, a highly controversial theory of change that argues we can do more with less. Proponents of degrowth argue for extensive redistribution of wealth and capital in service of solving the world's biggest problems. And they argue that this is the only way we address climate change, and it's the only way we really bring nations out of poverty and hunger and into self-sufficiency and sovereignty. But detractors paint degrowth as an extreme austerity, one that would dismantle our modern quality of life. I asked two guests to join me today, Yorgos Kallis, author of The Case for Degrowth, and Philka Sikolova, who does research not only on degrowth, but also on happiness. These are two perspectives that I think we need to bring together if we want to understand the truly radical potential for degrowth. So let's dig in. Today, I am excited because we have two amazing guests joining the show. First is Yorgos Kallis, an ecological economist at the Institute of Environmental Science and Technology in Barcelona. He is the author of two critical books on this topic, Limits and The Case for Degrowth. His current work explores sustainable degrowth as a solution to the economic and ecological crises facing global society. And also with us is Philka Sikolova, a member of the academic think tank Research in Degrowth, who also does research on sustainable degrowth and nature-based solutions in cities. Happiness is also a key part of her work and one that I'm really keen to explore today. Philka and Yorgos, thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Phil.
Philka, I'd like to put the first question to you, if that's all right. Degrowth may not be a term that many of our listeners have heard of, and if they have, it's hard to say what version of the concept and from who they've learned about it. So can you get us started by explaining in general terms what degrowth is and why it has become such a critical concept in issues like sustainability and climate change?
Thank you, Phil. I would suggest degrowth is firstly a hypothesis. Hypothesis that we could live better with less. Or basically that we could achieve equitable redistribution on a global level, along with downscaling or downsizing of the world economy, in a way that we could maintain our levels of well-being or actually improve it, and importantly, contribute to justice and equity. That's, let's say, the academic research around degrowth.
Okay.
But an important second part of degrowth has to do with the politics of it. So degrowth is, let's say, a political slogan or a political call to abandon the centrality of growth as a kind of overarching societal objective or as a kind of political imperative. So then degrowth is the call for radical reorganization of politics, as well as a kind of a call for political resistance to mining, let's say large-scale mining, large-scale energy projects, and energy infrastructure, as an example. Third, I will define degrowth as a kind of plethora of praxis, let's say now manifested through a range of community-based initiatives.
Okay, that's a very clear answer, but it's very high level. So I wonder, How can we ground this for people, say, to something that they're seeing in the news?
Let's say we could talk a lot more on degrowth, what it is about, but let me share why is it important to talk about. Then let's take the current and largely failed, in my opinion, talks around COP26 in Glasgow, right? Well, we have pretty stable evidence that climate warming above 1.5 degrees is likely to have serious, long-lasting, perhaps irreversible consequences for the natural system as well as the human ecosystem, right? So climate specialists, let's say, like Kaiser and Lensen in an article in Nature Communications, clearly state that staying within the 1.5, let's say, scenario without dependence on highly risky and highly speculative technologies, such as like carbon capture and storage, is completely impossible without degrowth actually in energy or and material terms. So that's actually the only safe path to address the climate disaster.
The only safe path. So then why, Yorgos, is this so controversial? I mean, it seems as though people either fully grasp and embrace it or cast it off as naive or dangerous or problematic. You know, we're recording this just following a major climate-driven disaster in Western Canada with, you know, the washout of highways because of a very large storm that's essentially cut off one of Canada's largest city from the rest of the from the rest of the nation. Why do you think, Yorgos, what is it about growth that is so hard for people to think critically about that it's that's made it the kind of dogma that it is? I mean, you know, I see sometimes, you know, in social media, people talking about degrowth and some of the responses they get are from people acting like we're talking about turning off the sun or gravity or, you know, why do you think people cling so staunchly to growth?
Because I think the current economy is capitalist economies and the way they work in order to be stabilized both socially and economically, they need growth. So it's not just a fantasy or a myth. I mean, it is a myth in a sense that, you know, the particular way that we've come to see our economies and the way they are structured around growth rests on a belief system. You know, we know about societies that they had gods, and if you think about the Aztecs, but, you know, they believed in the gods, they had whole structure built around the gods. They had the whole society depending around the gods. So once you stop believing these gods, it's not that suddenly you have like the same society working better. You can have a sudden collapse because the whole building is built around these gods. So in our case, I think it's somewhat similar, probably even worse, because it's not just the belief system of gods and rituals, but it's also our whole production, consumption, everyday living is geared around a system that depends on economic growth in order to be stable. So it is true that in the current system, without growth, things are pretty tricky, to say the least. No, and when there is decrease in GDP, they are pretty shitty. So that's the everyday experience of everyone. So to step out of that and have the courage to start asking the question or whether it could be different is not easy. And
you know, I think it's worth noting, Yorgos, though, that this thing we call growth and this indicator that so many use to speak about what a healthy economy entails, it doesn't just happen in a void. In fact, it's largely subsidized over the years by the violent plunder and incessant plunder of people in places elsewhere, particularly in the global south. And it does take courage to step away from that. It takes courage just to admit it. So one of the things I want to circle back to in terms of the practicality of this as of degrowth and the critique of it as a political movement is often many of the critiques look at the developing and underdeveloped world and say, what about them? And, you know, it's great for the so-called global north to be talking about degrowth. But, you know, the critique is, what about the rest? And this is to either of you. What about all of the people who still, you know, are coping with poverty and hunger and malnutrition?
The counter argument that we have to continue growing or we have to have strong economy so as to lift up the global south, it's a hypocrisy, because no, we have had growing economies by putting down the global south, and that's what actually, so it's within this system that we have also to understand the relationship between global north and global south. So the relationship between global north and global south is not two independent parts that one has managed to do well and the other one hasn't managed to do well, and we are generous and we have to help them also do well, you know. It's a story of one part getting rich on the backs of the other by exploiting the other, by exploiting it, by getting cheap resources, using the people from there as slaves, then just ravaging their commodities. And then in a later era where there was the decolonial movement, or there were governments that threw out the colonizing forces, this continued, but with a different guise, through free trade agreements that they were very uneven, through corporations going there with and exploiting poverty and paying very low salaries and not taking any care of local environments in ways that completely they wouldn't do in their own countries. So in that way, we continue to have in the global north a steady stream of cheap goods, cheap because the environments are treated as cheap in other parts of the world, cheap also because people are paid a fraction of what they would have been paid here to produce these goods. So that's the relationship between global north and south. And the question is whether what we are calling about the growth would change something in this direction. And I think it would change. On the one hand, it would stop this continuing demand from the global north for cheaper and cheaper goods and more growth and exploitation of the rest of the world. So it would relieve some of this pressure. A reduction also of demand in the global north could be good in the sense that it would be also an opportunity, an added opportunity for the global south to delink, as some scholars have called it, to disconnect from this dependency relationship with the north and try to use their resources, their human resources and their natural resources in ways that provide for local needs. They're not export driven and they're not to satisfy the needs of consumer and capitalists.
I think we ought to take a moment to get really concrete with the changes that degrowth can entail. As we've heard so far, it means shifting away from pursuing GDP growth and focusing instead on provisioning for human needs and well-being by reducing inequality, ensuring a living wage, or shortening the working week to maintain full employment for everyone. It can mean guaranteeing universal access to healthcare, education, transportation, affordable housing, and so on. The idea is that we can achieve strong social outcomes without growth, which opens up space to reduce ecologically destructive practices and start making up for the plunder of the global south that our lives are currently built upon. But what about in practice? Here are some examples, many drawn from a recent essay in Nature Energy, written by Yorgos and a number of his colleagues. In the transportation sector, for example, we could shift from private cars to public and non-motorized transportation. In the industrial sector, we can extend product lifespans through warranty mandates, through right to repair bills, and regulations against planned obsolescence. We do not need new cell phones every year. In the agricultural sector, we can minimize food waste, shorten supply chains, remove plastics from supply chains, and shift to agroecology. And in cities, we can reinvent how we plan urban spaces, create so-called 15-minute urban centers that require little motorized travel and that repurpose space that's presently taken up by the burden of parking structures and roads, and turn that into infrastructure for walking, biking, and other non-motorized mobility. Now, these are not the flashy solutions that were being sold by the likes of Elon Musk, but they're far more elegant, and they will improve our life if we let them. They just require that we admit that we've taken some things, like disposability and getting new phones every year and car culture, too far. Now back to the interview. So one of the things I want to turn to then is, Philke, your work on happiness and how, you know, I'd really like to talk about what life on the other side of changing the growth paradigm looks like, feels like, and because I think that's another way at understanding the value of this degrowth paradigm and political movement, and also the critique of all of the assumptions we make around what growth gets us and what it in fact doesn't. Can you tell us what we get right and what we get wrong from your work when we think about happiness? And how do we change how we think about the relationship between our happiness and our economy or jobs or livelihoods?
Yeah, I'm always a bit scared to talk about happiness in generic terms because this is something so personal and so kind of experiential and so culturally independent and so socially constructed that it's like generalizing by default brings always kind of a degree of error. So kind of bear me with that one. But I'm a self-affirmed supporter of the Easterling paradox. And even though kind of many economists are trying to disprove it with some statistical twists, I don't find them convincing. I mean, Easterling paradox, for those who don't know about it, indicates that once basic material kind of needs of human societies, mostly in the West, have been covered, the continuous accumulation of wealth does not bring about an increase in happiness, per se. So extreme versions of materialism, or like along the keeping up with the Joneses, actually suffocate our life satisfaction and our search for life meaningfulness. They throw us in depression, in burnout, and then let us accept unconscious level of stress that kind of that continuously somehow perpetuate in us. Because humans, we tend to adapt to material type of gains. So materialism goes along with an acceleration in our psychological and physiological system, which cannot bear that acceleration too much without breaking down. So in that sense, the growth in terms of downscaling is needed for the sake of connecting with life. I guess, just to give an example, many of us at some point in our life have been in a dilemma between, let's say, accepting a better kind of a well-paid job or kind of undertaking or just project, which will apply a lot of responsibility, a lot of work, a lot of stress, versus just staying as before, just like keeping it to something more simple that's not paying so much. And somehow the environment that we're situated in somehow pushing us to go always higher and upper in the ladder. But we need to be aware which decisions are authentically ours and which are decisions actually pushed, at least to be aware by external factors.
One of the sort of gesso stories that I've heard shared in a variety of contexts to help people connect with the notion of degrowth and what it looks like is a story about running a factory, you know, say a factory that makes personalized mugs and it's a great business and the family does very well. And then a new machine is made that could make twice as many mugs in the same amount of time. And you mentioned decisions, and the family faces a decision point. Do they buy the machine and then grow and produce twice as many mugs, or do they buy the machine and then take half of the time off and do other things with their life? And those kind of inflection points, different people would say that the decision is obvious. And so I feel like, you know, degrowth, as you said, along with happiness, it comes down to very personal understandings of one's purpose and goals and visions for their lives and needs.
Let me say something about the mugs, which I think links, because I think to answer these questions, we have to be a little bit more to look at the individual and the collective, but also understand the political economy of capitalism if we need these decisions are taking place. Otherwise, we put too much of the burden on people, which of course each person has the responsibility, but the factory owners that you said, or the small business which makes mugs, has to take the machine and has to produce twice, because if it doesn't, it will be overtaken by competitors and then it won't produce anything and just close down. So they don't really have a choice to take it easy. That much we know, since, I mean, Marx wrote that 200 years ago. So it's not any big discovery. But like capitalism, it's not a matter of whether you want to take it easy, you don't want to take it easy. It's a system that it's based on competition. And you either grow or you die if you decide to stay back and take it easy. I mean, you might decide to take it easy if you can have a niche market. I don't know, people just love your mugs because they're very special and they're just made by your own hands. That for some reason they love them and then they buy them and then you have your own market. So then you might decide that you want to take it easy, but that's like a small part of the real economy. In the real economy, you produce mugs, And if you don't take the machine and if you don't underpay your workers, someone will go to China and produce the Macs there. And then after China, they're going to go to sub-Saharan Africa and produce it there cheaper with cheaper people and will kick you out of the market. So that's the system within which we're operating and which makes growth an imperative. The growth would like to change that.
Or to put it in the words of Gregory Bateson, it's a double bind. It's you're stuck either way. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
So one of the things I would like to ask both of you, and I ask everybody who joins this show, it's a show about change. It's a show about helping people think about and envisioning radical change. What is the most radical change that each of you would like to see in your lifetime? And how close do you think we are?
Oh, Jorgos, you go first. That's a tough one.
Yeah, there is a distance between what we would like to see, and we are always grounded by reality and by what is possible. Ideally, what I would like to see is societies that come to terms with what we are talking about here, that come to terms with a climate breakdown and they manage to stop it. Societies that restore a sense of global justice and redistribution and have more equality within them. So my ideal would be, like, I don't know, 50 years from now, to have reduced carbon emissions dramatically, have restored ecosystems, and also have societies that have no hierarchies or no permanent hierarchies, and they're not based on class differences and huge differences of income and wealth between their individuals. So that would be the ideal, and societies that they are what we could say governing the commons, so that the commons and governing together the commons is the organizing principle, which doesn't mean big state governments managing the commons, but it means an articulation between local communities, municipalities, state governments, but with an emphasis on managing of the public, so the public trust of the commons together. So that would be my ideal scenario for 50 years from now. How close we are to it? I think we're very far from it, and we are not getting closer. I mean, there are people who are pushing hard to get closer, but then there is also a reaction to go in a very opposite direction of solidifying hierarchies, using violence to protect your own.
Yeah, and I've been leaning in the direction of, you know, as a systems thinker, when that resistance really ramps up, it means you're closer to the tipping point, not further away, because that's when the status quo starts realizing that there's actually a threat of change. And so I lean in the direction of optimism, and that the things that seem like backtracks or losses of ground, increased use of violence, that these actually indicate perhaps that with the right kind of pushing, maybe we're close. Philka, what about you?
Well, I just first imagined that I can't imagine this utopian future without thinking of the path to getting there. And I imagine it is very thorny. And I also imagine that our walking, the process of walking to there is going to change us. It's going to bring us new terms, new ways of seeing the world. I find it difficult to rationally predict that future, because we're going to be so dramatically changed. So imagine us so dramatically changed from what we are now that it's kind of unthinkable. But for example, if I think of the most radical changes that I would like to see, I will start with financial markets. And I would say, like, we ban financial markets and we ban the kind of the shareholder structure of corporations and have enterprises which are not forced to pay off to their shareholders. And again, for me, one of the most radical changes would have to do with redistribution and taxing the wealth, taxing the rich, and abandoning tax havens, all that, let's say, mostly economic financial parts, which will have very big implication for kind of meeting sustainability targets as well.
Those are radical changes, and I see them as, you know, the premise of the show is, it's called the second transition, because I think of all of these really difficult changes that change us. And, you know, it's one thing, you know, the process, for example, of redistribution of wealth, that doesn't go on forever. There's a point after that. But it's such a tremendously changed paradigm of how to live. It's if we could predict it, we'd be in it.
Yorgos and Philke,
thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you to the work that you do, Philip. It's great what you're doing.
This episode of the Second Transition Podcast was produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northeastern California. You heard today from Yorgos Kallis, author of the books Limits and The Case for Degrowth, and Philke Sikolova. Funding for this podcast comes in part from the Arrow Food Institute, from the University of Guelph, and from Voice Ed Radio. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.